The material that we're doing for today, first of all, it's the last thing we're reading in this session. We're going to have a break of about a month. We start again on June 30th, and we will have a practice day for that. And I've been thinking probably the best way to do that would be June 23rd. Because it'll be a way of warming everybody up again to get started. And then over the summer, we'll have another six-week session. And in that session, we will finish the time section. And maybe we'll figure out. Figure out is really exactly the wrong kind of knowing, you know. When you figure something out, it means that you've substituted whatever you figured out for real knowledge. But that's just my comment on the language of it. But anyway, maybe we will develop a better sense of the special kind of knowing that is involved with unknown time. The unknowing that's also a knowingness. That's what we're exploring today. And it's a subtle and sophisticated presentation that Rinpoche is making here. And when I was preparing for class, I was really struck by the fact that, you know, it's pretty remarkable that because we've been working with this material for a while, we can really follow along. We really can make some sense out of what Rinpoche is saying and hopefully tie it into our experience and the way that we've been exploring the TSK vision in our own lives. I think it's wonderful that we have the chance to do that. So, let's talk about what we're doing. Let's try to think our way through the rest of this chapter, the end of this chapter, and then we'll end pretty close to the end. We'll do a practice and have some discussion of it. So the question that Rinpoche asked, it's actually at the very end of page 137, so at the end of the reading we did for last week, is he says we have to see how or whether our consciousness can remain connected to the hidden time of founding. That's the question that we're exploring. There is, you know, we've been exploring this idea that there is a time which is unknown. Here he calls it hidden. We'll see more about the relationship between being hidden and being unknown in a little bit. And somehow he's saying we would like to, for our consciousness to remain connected to that hidden time of founding. And it's a kind of a paradox to say it that way, because the word consciousness, and I'm not sure that this is rigorously maintained in the TSK books, but in general, consciousness is very much tied to our specific human consciousness and our specific way of knowing. You know, it's different from awareness, certainly, which is what Rinpoche goes on to talk about in the reading for today. So you might say, well, that's exactly the problem. All we have is our consciousness. All we have is our own way of using the mind. And that, by definition, is not able to connect to this hidden time of founding. So it's a paradox. And yet, you know, we want to be operating within the space of that paradox. We want to be looking for a way to make that possible. So what that means to start off with is that there is that we really have to acknowledge that you know, what we're looking for is not just some kind of knowledge that, you know, that's in a direction we didn't think to look, or, you know, sometimes you could use that image, but it's not as though you've been, you know, you lost something and you're looking through, you know, one set of drawers, and then suddenly you realize, oh, you know, there's this other set of drawers I could look in. It's not like that. It really is unknown. We're talking about a time of knowing, or a time of a founding time, and we can't find it in any of the conventional ways. And we can't, you know, if you say, well, how do you engage it? we can't give any kind of conventional answer. Now, one way of looking for an answer is through investigating in our own experience and you know, changing the variables, changing how we engage experience and looking in different places. I just said not looking in different places, but now I'm thinking in a different sense, looking in dimensions that we don't usually think to look in. So that's one way to investigate. But it's not, there's no answer. There's no secret answer. Rinpoche has said that in various places. You know, people think that there's some answer that he's not, or that, you know, we have to really study hard to get. There isn't an answer to how we can stay connected to the hidden time of founding. There's only the possibility of being in the world in that way. There's no answer to the question. There's just the doing of it. So, what that means is you know, there isn't. It's not as though we have to get to some different level of reality. And if we had more time, we could go into that, but I don't think we need to. We can make the assumption that, you know, we only have our consciousness, we only have our way of knowing, and there isn't anywhere else to go. And actually, Rinpoche talks about that in a very interesting way later in this reading. We'll come back to it. But what he's doing here, what he does in this section, which is really remarkable, you know, I don't think there's anybody else. I mean, I haven't read everything, but you know, I think it's very remarkable, rare to say, well, the possibility of access is time. You know, people have written a lot about time. But they very seldom go to this level, and I'm not going to try to define what, you know, what's different about this approach, because we already know. That's what we've been exploring for actually many months now. But it's, you know, he's starting to bring it together, and you know, this section that we're reading right now, this little subsection, is called The Merging of Time and Awareness. And that's the move that we're counting on at this point to open up possibilities that are not otherwise available. So Sudhi asks and exclaims. You can see if you look at the chat section. It's a way of being in time. Yes, it is. Or maybe we could say, it's a way for being to time, or, you know, which sounds a little funny, I guess. Or, you know, it's a way of timing being. The only reservation I have about the way Sudhi says it, it's a way of being in time, is that it's not a way for us to be in time, because we can't do that. And that's the paradox we talked about before. You know, consciousness by definition can't really be in time in that way. But of course, you know, at different times we have to use different language, and I think this definitely points in the right direction. It's a way of being in time. So we want to engage that. At the same time, we can't try to turn what's unknown into something that's known, because then we've lost it. So also in the previous reading, 137. Rinpoche says that there's this unknown time, which in some sense is a basis for the temporal order. But it's obviously not a thing, a basis in the usual sense, because whatever shows up, whatever we could point to and say that's the basis, is going to be within the temporal order. So we have to do it differently. We have to allow it to remain unknown, but also allow for the possibility that it doesn't have to stay hidden. So So again, we're kind of right on the edge of paradox. That's why I said it's pretty remarkable that we can actually even make sense out of this. And right now I'm just meaning conceptually make sense out of it. We need to continue to explore it in our experience. But, you know, this difference between being hidden and being unknown, we can bring it into the open even though it stays unknown. And so maybe we have to emphasize the word unknown here. We can bring it into the open, but when we do that, it doesn't become known. It stays unknown. Okay. That's reasonably clear. There's actually a Rinpoche has a way of saying that right at the top of 138, at the start of the reading, which I think is very simple and clear. Sudhi has another comment, but let's look at this, and then maybe we can look ahead to the point Sudhi's referring to. At the end of that first paragraph, he's talking about this deeper structure, he says, this deeper structure which is not available to be known, but is intimately active in all that we experience. So that's, I think, really very, very clear and helpful. It's a little like saying, this is not a great example, but it's a little bit like, you know, something has been bothering you, and then let's say you realize that you're angry at someone, and before you didn't realize it, and now you know. So now, you know, your temporal order has shifted and you understand that you're angry with this person. But I'm actually interested more in what happens before you realize that. That's why this isn't a great example, because here that shift can happen. But before you realize it, your anger, you could say, is intimately active, right, in everything that you experience. It's shaping, coloring everything that you experience. This is something like that. Probably it's not a good enough example to stay with, but let's move on. Maybe it was somewhat helpful. So intimately active, that's what we want to look at. Maybe a better example, a very traditional spiritual example, is fish that swim in water can never know water, right? And yet it's, in a sense, you could say it's intimately active in their whole experience. Okay, so Sudhi says, he says more or less possible. So that's why Rinpoche also says, I'm reading from Sudhabe's note here, that's why he also says more or less possible, more or less possible, due to how one engages the temporal order or the dynamic time, it shifts. Yeah, that's true. When you engage the dynamic of time, something shifts and the temporal order shifts along with it. Let's look at that quote. We're going a little out of order here, but it's okay. On page 139, this idea of possible, more or less possible, he actually says that in, I think, a wonderful way. It's the second full paragraph on 139. He says, within this unknownness, before naming, before setting goals, before the separation of time and knowledge, I'll come back to that, a new temporal knowing presents itself. Not known to the conventional order, not known to the conventional order, you could say, or in the conventional order, but foundational for that order, I think that's all clear from what we've been saying, it is both more and less than possible. I think that's a wonderful formulation. It's less than possible in the sense that there's no possibility for knowing it within the temporal order, but it's more than possible in the sense that it founds the temporal order. I think you could say more about that, but that will do for us right now. Okay. So Bruce says he thought that was a helpful explanation that I gave. A helpful example of an implicit ordering dynamism. I like that. Implicit ordering dynamism. And so it keeps us on the level of the temporal order, but it's showing that within the temporal order, there's a kind of a multiple dimensionality, which we've talked about before. And that helps point us toward this truly unknown dimension. So I wanted to come back to the point that's made at the beginning of this paragraph. The unknownness, he says, that it's before the separation of time and knowledge. So, you know, that's very beautiful. And that's what I said at the beginning. It's kind of the remarkable move that Rinpoche makes in here, and it's one of the remarkable things. There's many remarkable things in the TSK vision. It's a remarkable move because, you know, what he says is that whatever way we have of knowing, and that relates back to our consciousness, is given by the temporal order. And so it's given by this unknown founding time. But that's every kind of knowing that we can kind of lay claim to, that we can say, well, that's one of the possibilities for knowing. But more fundamental than that is the knowing itself, or I should say the founding temporality itself. And that is linked to a knowing that is not separate from that temporality. So I think there is a good image we could think of here, which is the knowledge that's implicit in our DNA. You know, I don't usually like scientific analogies too much, but I think here that's helpful. Our human being, our embodied nature, and for that matter, our mental nature as well, is an expression of our DNA. And so the DNA encodes a certain kind of knowledge. Now, all of that is a little bit too simple for what we're talking about here, but it's a good analogy. Whatever it is we know, there's this founding knowing, which then is expressed in our DNA, and he uses another very interesting phrase at the bottom of page 138. He says, in the first sentence of the last paragraph, he says, only unknown time can make this possible, can draw on temporality to conduct experience into being and broadcast awareness into facticity. So facticity is a technical philosophical term in the West, but I think here the idea is you know, it's not one particular fact or set of facts. It's the very truth that we live in a world in which there are certain facts that are true. You know, that's the facticity of the world, and time, this unknown time that we're exploring, broadcasts awareness into facticity. So there's the underlying awareness which merges with time, and that's what this whole section is about, to give us a temporal order with its facticity, which is with its particular reality. So very interesting. Okay, Sudhi asks here, is intuition or an intuitive way of being more in the realm of dynamic time than the temporal ordered way? Well, you know, there are, I would say, there are different temporal orders. There's an infinite possible range of temporal orders. And in fact, our temporal order, you could say, or the field communique, these were all closely linked terms, or the tempo, that's the word Rinpoche used in the last reading, but it's not one that he uses very much. But any of those, the temporal order, the field communique, the tempo, I'm sure there are others, I think they're actually constantly shifting. So for instance, if I think about something that happened yesterday and then I notice what's going on around me, I would say those are two different temporal orders. They overlap with each other, but they're different. And an intuitive way of being, it depends on how much weight you want to give the word intuitive. I think there are temporal orders in which we can touch something within ourselves, a way of knowing that's more intuitive. And that's just another possibility. And it's maybe a very helpful and interesting possibility, but it's just another possibility. So I'd say that it doesn't yet get to this unknown merging of time and awareness, this unknown founding time. Now, if you wanted to give the word intuition a whole lot of weight, if you wanted to make it really strong, then you could say it really is getting closer to the dynamic of time. So it depends partly what you mean by it. Okay, here's a note from Karen. Normally we're convinced to know reality. That is, I think we're convinced that we know reality and believe in our experience. In the moment, we really believe that we do not know, that our knowing is really limited. There's more ease and maybe appreciation. Is this what you're explaining, Jack? Well, I think it's similar to the question Sudhi asked about intuition. If I understand it correctly, and if I don't, please try again. But, okay, I think I now understand. Now I'm reading it differently, Karen. I think I understand. You're saying, in the moment we really believe that we do not know, that our knowing is really limited, that in itself gives us more ease and maybe more appreciation. Yes, I think that's true. In other words, recognizing that our knowledge is limited, but at the same time, you have to recognize that that's not a limitation on knowledge. It's a limitation on our knowledge. It's a limitation on our particular way of knowing. And that if we could touch this more dynamic time, maybe not touch it, but if we could activate it in some way or connect with it, as he says in that quote we started with today, if we could do that, then yes, certainly, there would be more ease and more appreciation, and a kind of a spontaneous awareness, which is, you know, which arises out of that moment, what Rinpoche calls in this reading actually the prior. It arises out of that prior before the temporal order is established. And before time and awareness have split off from each other. Okay, let me take a look at what Michael asks here. Is facticity an ascribed quality like substance or sequence or something more fundamental? Well, I'm inclined to say it's more fundamental, but I'm not sure. We'd have to discuss substance and sequence because they sound pretty basic, don't they? We live in a world in which there is substance. We live in a world in which things arise in sequence. Those do sound very, very basic. And yet, at least the way I'm thinking of the word facticity, it's more that there is something at all. So sometimes in Western philosophy, they make a distinction that's helpful. Between what it is and that it is. Right? So whatever goes on in our experience, we want to try to find out what it is. We want to get clear about it. But there's something more fundamental than that, which is that it is, and that's the facticity. So substance is very close to that, but very basic. The facticity part is very basic. Okay, I don't think I'm going to try to talk about the difference between being hidden and being hidden-ed, the term that he uses here that refers back to something from last quarter, but I do want us to practice for a little bit. let's look at a couple of ways you might practice with what's being said here that we won't do, and then we'll go to the one that we will do. On page 139, he talks about, let's see if I can find it here. Yeah, in the third paragraph on page 139, just after what we were reading, we just read the part about being more and less than possible. And then he says, perhaps we can simply allow for this more and lessness. In allowing, we step away from the tight constriction of the prevailing order. Although we have not departed from the known, we may already be in the presence of a hidden opening. That's where the hidden comes, to unknown time and unconditioned knowledge. I think this is actually related to what Karin was talking about. It's allowing for not knowing. And here it's talked about in the specific sense of it's allowing for this new temporal order, this unknown order, to be less than is possible and more than is possible. And I think especially allowing for the more than is possible. That would be a way to practice. That would be a practice to try out. We're not going to do it. Not right now. But I encourage you to think about it or explore it. That's probably better. What Rinpoche tries to do here, what he invites us in this next section to do, he says, okay, we could just try allowing it. That's what he just said. But he also wants to give us another possibility. And the possibility here is really to challenge one of these very basic structures. It's actually pretty much the structure of sequence that Michael mentioned. You could say more in terms of causality. He's saying, well, if we wanted to get to a different kind of knowing, really an awareness that was before awareness and time separated, how could we do that? And he's talking here really about how it's very difficult to ask that question because we're so tied in to past, present, and future. And in particular, we're tied in to the past. He talks here about seeing. This is about 15 lines down on page 140. He says, we see with pastness eyes. And what he means by that, of course, is that what we identify, what we're able to know, is already what has entered the past. It's in Love of Knowledge, he refers to that as descriptive knowledge. The kind of knowledge that's available to us, as long as we're looking from the point of view of a self, is a knowledge that's always looking backward, even if it's looking backward at what just happened. So we look back, and the discussion here, he's talking about we trace things backwards, to the cause, to the origin, we identify the sequence. We're always looking for a from. So this is on page 141, in the first full paragraph. I think that's very clear. He says, when we analyze, and what he means by analysis here, the particular kind of analysis he's talking about, is an analysis in which we can only make sense out of the past. The future always has to remain unknown. Now, he's suggesting the possibility here, and it's one that we've looked at a number of times, that the unknownness of the future is really a wonderful point of connection to the unknownness of this more fundamental founding time. But he's saying we, again, because we can only rely on our consciousness, our way of knowing, the future just stays unknown in a way that seems completely blocked because our knowledge depends on depends on tracing things out. And if we're going to look for a source for time, we inevitably, the only way we can think of for doing that is by looking in terms of the past. I mean, you could say, well, yeah, just leave it at that. So, you know, that's the discussion here in the first full paragraph on 141 about looking at arising from and thinking that we know what from means, right? And that always keeps us caught within the temporal order. And then he says, you know, the other possibility, he introduces this word that I've mentioned already, which is instead of looking from, look to a prior. And it's just another word, and the word prior usually has the same sense of earlier in time. But here he's trying to use it as a technical term where he says it's not caught up with the temporal order. Right? So he says in the second paragraph, before past and future and the tracings of the linear order, there is the prior of unknown time. And he says, regarding this prior, we cannot say it is gone, nor can we say it has never arrived. I'm not going to try to say anything about that. I will suggest that another place to practice with this, or another way to practice with this, and you might find it a useful way, you know, now as we're heading toward the break, is to look at the sequence of exercises in the first TSK book. I think it's exercises 18 through 21, which have to do with the directionality of time. It's a very nicely structured set of exercises that really questions our usual commitment to the structure of from and to, and is an invitation in the terms used here, I think, an invitation to enter into or connect with the prior. So that's another place that you might try practicing as we go ahead. But I'm going to try something different now. This is where I want to have us practice for at least a couple of minutes. And the connection is there. I'm now looking at page 142, and in the second full paragraph, and this is in a section called Awakening the Unknown, at the end of the second paragraph, he's asking, well, how could we arrive at the prior? And he says something really, really important and characteristic of TSK. And that is, he says, we can't be in a position to reject anything. We can't make distinctions, you know, and he's specifically talking here about the self. And we've been saying, oh, well, the knowledge of the self, that won't work. It doesn't go far enough, deep enough. And that's, I think, fair to say. But he says that doesn't mean we can reject the self. We can't reject the emotions of the self. We can't reject the claims of its identity. We can't reject, I'm just reading here from this paragraph, we can't reject the pain that it inflicts, because that's the reality we inhabit. And we have to be able to, as he says here in this last sentence on this paragraph, he says, to arrive at the prior, we must first inhabit fully our presenting world, whatever its content and obscuring patterns. And there's another place, I don't see it right now in the text, where he says, you know, you don't just go for the, oh, here it is. It's at the bottom of 143. He says, we do not have to turn away from what's happening in our lives right now. We do not have to reject our previous history. Knowledge is available not only in the beautiful and the perfect, but in the twisted, the perverse, and the misdirected. And then he goes on to say other things, which I won't go into right now. But that's this idea of inhabiting fully. And so the practice that I'd like us to look at for a couple of minutes and then see if people have any reaction, although I haven't left us very much time for that, is really comes straight out of the next to the last paragraph in the chapter. It's on the top of page 144. It says, in each moment, we can choose and cherish knowledge in all appearance. So this is the part about not rejecting anything, and inhabiting fully. And that's what he goes on to say. He says, we can choose and cherish knowledge in all appearance. We can awaken our sensitivity. So this is a specific instruction. You know? So the general idea of the practice is we're going to choose and cherish knowledge in all appearance, and in all appearances, you could say. We can awaken our sensitivity and react newly to what arises. So in each moment, be sensitive and react newly to each moment. We can cut each instant rejection of knowledgeability. So that's the second step. We awaken our sensitivity and react newly. It's the first step. We cut each rejection, and that basically means the tendency to judge and to say, well, this is not me, or this is not something I like, or this is not true or real or fundamental. This is twisted and perverted, to use that language. None of that. There's none of that that happens, because in each moment we're choosing knowledge in all appearance, or we're cherishing knowledge in all appearance and in all appearances. So that's the second step. And then the third step, you could say, brings those two together, and we already talked about it, inhabit what has happened. So we, in each moment, we awaken our sensitivity so that we can react newly. We cut off any tendency to reject, and we inhabit the whole of what's happening. So let's try that for a couple of minutes, and then see if there's see where how people react to that. Okay, here we go. Okay, so let's come together, and I'll give you all a chance to share any reflections, put anything in the chat room. Does anybody want to say anything? Okay, well, I do. Okay, great. Yeah, it's, you know, the notion of cutting each rejection, I think is really important, and the kind of the quality of TSK is a quality of acceptance. You know, it's not, Rinpoche says in one of the other books, the self is not the enemy. So what I would say, you know, we would need to explore. I mean, this in itself is just a remarkable practice, and you could do it, you could spend months, really, making this your basic practice if you wish to. So it's the cherishing of knowledge, the awakening of sensitivity, and then this notion of cutting rejection, cutting instant rejection. That's where you say to yourself, oh, I screwed up. I'm not doing it right. I've lost my connection to knowledge, or I've lost my connection to time. That move is not necessary, and we can cut it. So, okay, Karin says, in German we call this einfach loslassen. The self is working hard not to do so, but to conduct. Right, it's, you know, quite some time ago we talked about conducting and two ways of thinking about conducting. The self thinks that it's got to be the conductor, which is similar to being the witness. But there's also a conducting, which is like conducting the flow of electricity in a cable, which is a letting go. You know, how does electricity flow in a cable? Well, it's when all the resistance is removed, or when you close the circuit, when you just let the electricity flow, you remove the obstacle. Well, then it flows, and we conduct. So einfach loslassen just means simply letting go. It's not one of these very technical German philosophical terms. It just means simply letting go. And we can say that, and we can practice that. But there is something very particular about the way it's presented here. Awakening our sensitivity, reacting newly, cutting each instant rejection of knowledgeability, and then inhabiting, and there's so much to say about inhabiting. We could go on, but we can't because we're almost out of time. David writes in the chat box, full sensual experience, inhabiting the full limits of what I feel, what I hear, beyond body, an expansion of awareness. Yeah, those are exactly the kinds of things we would want to explore. What does it mean to inhabit what is happening? When we inhabit fully. And we actually spend a lot of energy, it seems to me, to keep from inhabiting fully what our experience is. This is an invitation to stop putting our energy into cutting off, you know, like closing off the flow of the conducting electricity, to stop putting our energy there and to just let experience flow, which means connecting, really, at some level. When we do that, we're connecting to unknown time, and that means we're also connecting to the awareness, the knowledge that's available before knowledge and time become separated, which is what we were talking about earlier. Okay, Sudaba asks a question, and this will be our this will be the last thing. So she says, how is one able to shift important issues in humanity's realms in the prior? Oh, well, okay. Brigitte sneaked one in there too, so we'll look at what she has to say. Okay. So how is one able to shift important issues in humanity's realm in the prior? So it's not the priori, although that's actually not an interesting word, but the prior. When everyone else takes a position, what happens in my reality and mind and realm seems isolated? Okay, well, that's a very interesting question for reflection. I'm not going to try to say too much about it now. Let me just say how I understand the question. What we see around us, what happens in our world is that everybody is busy relying on the knowledge that they think of themselves as owning. Everybody is busy taking a position. Right? And if I'm practicing something other than that, if I'm letting knowledge arise in an inseparable intimacy with unknown time, doesn't that kind of isolate me from the rest of the world? So I think a quick answer to that would be to say, no. That's the quick answer. No, because what you're engaging is, you know, not it's your experience, but your experience encompasses everybody else that you're interacting with. And the possibility for that kind of intimate engaging and cherishing of knowledge does not leave other people out. Now, they may not be so tuned in to what's going on, but you have the possibility of acting from this other place. That's not an adequate answer because it's a big question, but maybe that's enough for us to start with. So Brigitte writes, cutting off tendencies of rejection sounds so clear, and as an option, seems so difficult. Would it not tear the root of every stress? I feel tendencies of rejection like made out of iron. I wish to cut them. How? Rejection is a source of self-protection. Letting go makes feel insecure. Well, another big question, but that's good. You know, the fact that we're asking big questions, I think, shows that we're starting to take on the significance of what these teachings are presenting. We're identified with the self in its way of knowing. And given that, yes, insecurity is natural. And rejection is a response to that. So rejection is very much related to fear. It's very much related to thinking our whole order, our whole way of making sense out of things will only work if we can hold on to some basic structures. It will only work if we've got things tuned up just right. And that's what we want to, that's what we're being invited to reconsider, let's say. So as you say, Brigitte, it sounds very clear. But as an option, it seems very difficult. The reason it seems so difficult is because we have a very strong commitment to a temporal order which centers on me. You know? The answer that's being offered here, and this goes back to the comment that Bruce made, and that's certainly in the text, is that we don't have to say, oh, my problem is that I'm so centered on me, I'm so focused on me, and if I could just let go of that and so on and so forth, everything would be fine. That is another kind of subtle level of rejection. Right? It's the self saying, well, we'd have to reject the self. And so then we say, well, we can't do that. So it's also difficult. Right? So it does seem very difficult. So the point is to be able to engage the structures of the self as a part of what appears. So the not cutting off rejection, where it says here, cutting each instant rejection of knowledgeability. The rejection of knowledgeability comes when we identify with the self, but it also comes when we say we have to get rid of the self. They're both different forms of rejection. I think that's fairly clear in light of what we've said. So take a look at this chapter, and I did give you a couple of other suggestions for how you could practice. We're going to take basically a month's break now, I'm thinking that the next practice day will be June 23rd. Then we start up again on June 30th, and we work our way through chapters 15 and 16, I believe. Yes. Okay.